And we're back. Good morning again, Charlottesville, and welcome to the Mind and Heart Show on WPVC 94.7, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. I am your host, Dr. Jeffrey Frazier. We are here live every Saturday morning from 9 to 10 a.m., and we deal with all matters of the mind and heart. Please join us by visiting our Facebook page at Mind and Heart Show. Send us a tweet at @mindheartwpvc. Or email us at mindheartwpvc@gmail.com. You can also call with a question or comment. We're at 434-284-9470. And we welcome all opinions and points of view. Our only ground rule is that we maintain civility during any discussion. I'm joined in the studio this morning by my producer, Morgan Geyer, who's keeping things running smoothly. And we have a special guest this morning, but before we get to that, I just wanted to give you a weather update. It is looking for a high of 66 today, so it should be a really good day for the Virginia Tech UVA football game. It's looking like we're going to get some showers possibly tomorrow, and there's going to be a gradual drop in temp in the early part of the week, so just check your weather before you go out. So I'm very pleased to welcome this morning Dr. Russ Fetterman. He's a clinical psychologist in Charlottesville and a colleague, and we are going to be talking about the treatment of individuals with bipolar disorder. So, welcome, Russ. Glad to have you here this morning.
Good morning, Jeff. Glad to be here.
Thanks. So, tell us, let's just begin. What interested you in psychology? What got you thinking about, you know, as a college student or whenever, that you might want to become a psychologist?
That's going way back. I actually really didn't have a clue.
Okay.
I got a bachelor's in psychology because I didn't know what else to do. And then I had several years of work experience after that in the human services field, got a master's in psychology, then worked as a master's level psychologist for 4 years before I was fairly clear that psychology was the field I wanted. And then I went back and did my doctorate. Finished my doctorate in 1982.
And where did you do that work?
At United States International University in San Diego,
right.
Which these days it's called Alliant University.
That's right.
Because it merged with California School of Professional Psychology.
Right. Okay. Now, you also have a diplomate status. Tell our listeners what that means. You have the ABEP, as we call it, the American Board of Professional Psychology Qualification. That's really the gold standard. So just tell us a bit about your diplomate status.
Well, you know, when you're looking at physicians' credentials, you'll often see the phrase board certified.
Right.
Well, essentially, the diplomate status in psychology is the psychologist's equivalent of being board certified, and for me, I'm board certified in clinical psychology.
And it's a fairly difficult path and relatively uncommon in the profession. I mean, I want to emphasize, I know you probably don't want to toot your own horn then, but just to let our listeners know that it's really quite a remarkable achievement, and it really says to those people with whom Russ deals, that he's really at the top of the food chain there. So it's very notable. So graduate school and then what, Russ, in terms of your career track?
Well, I was in private practice for probably about 13 years in San Diego, and essentially doing more psychoanalytically oriented psychotherapy. And as I began to see the impact of managed care on the ability to easily manage the finances of private practice, I decided it was time to go back to the drawing board. And I was fortunate in getting a job as director of mental health services at East Carolina University. That was in 91. And I did that for 9 years, and then a position opened up at UVA as director of counseling and psychological services in 2000. And was director at UVA CAPS is Counseling and Psych Services,
right?
From 2000 to 2013, at which point I transitioned back into private practice, decided to get out of the pressure cooker of university mental health, and moved back into the private sector.
So you really made a dramatic move from the West Coast to the East Coast when you took the position at East Carolina.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I did.
And if continue to be an East Coaster, we're very grateful for that since since you moved east. Just say a couple words about sort of the changes you've seen in college counseling centers. I know I've had concerns about resilience and just the increase in demand on college counseling centers for young people.
Goodness, enormous changes. If you really think of the broader culture, culture has shifted very significantly over the last 30, 40 years' time. We're in a time of a lot less economic security. It used to be that the path, you know, if you got a good education, then you could be relatively assured that you could put a career together. And I think we simply don't have that certainty these days. I think the stresses that we all face in living in this 24-hour news media cycle, where we're constantly informed of all of the bad things that are happening throughout the world, it essentially makes the world a much more unstable place. And I think growing up in an increasingly unstable environment, I think, leads to increasing insecurity, anxiety, depression. And across the board, you've seen increasing utilization of counseling centers at universities throughout the country over the last 20, 30 years' time. And very few counseling centers these days really have adequate resources to manage it. So even the largest centers that you'll see in the country typically find that they can barely keep up with the need. So there's been a very significant shift in late adolescent, early adult mental health issues.
Right. And I'm guessing around 2008, with the recession and the job market really contracting, that that really upped the anxiety and the pressure on students in terms of trying to get a job in the middle of a recession.
Sure. Absolutely. Okay. Absolutely.
Now, let me just mention that Russ is the co-author of the 2010 book called Facing Bipolar, The Young Adult's Guide to Dealing with Bipolar Disorder. And that's an important book. And then he's contributed two chapters to the 2012 book, Healthy Living with Bipolar Disorder. He writes an ongoing blog for Psychology Today, online magazine, called entitled Bipolar U. So, Russ, before we get into some of the specifics of bipolar, just for any of our listeners, we were going to talk about what role psychiatrists play in treating bipolar, what role we as psychologists play. But tell our listeners, just distinguish between what psychiatrists do and what we do, for those that may confuse the two professions.
Mm-hmm. Well, a psychiatrist has an MD, so they are a physician. And with regard to bipolar disorder, the role of psychiatry, in fact, bipolar disorder is typically treated primarily by psychiatrists, because medication really is one of the fundamental aspects of treatment delivery to those with bipolar disorder.
Okay.
It really is managing the medical psychopharmacological aspects of working with bipolar individuals, whereas social services your social service practitioners, such as your psychologists, counselors, social workers, deal more with the psychotherapy, the psychosocial aspects of helping folks live with bipolar disorder. So they're very different roles.
Okay. And in my experience as a practicing psychologist, it was relatively rare for me to treat bipolar individuals. Our practice tended to shove them all into the psychiatrist office. So, and we want to come back to that question in a few minutes. But just tell us, if you would, how you came to specialize in bipolar disorder as a clinical psychologist.
Sure, sure. You know, it was never anything that I at one point set out to do. It isn't like I had decided, gee, I think I want to develop expertise in working with bipolar. But at East Carolina University, I was hired to set up what they called the mental health services. And the mental health services was separate from the University Counseling Center.
Okay.
And the task of the mental health services was to treat those students with more complex and acute psychopathology. So over the course of my 9 years there, I probably saw much more of my share of individuals with bipolar disorder than I would have if I had been a psychologist at a full-range counseling center, because those patients would have been more, you know, broadly distributed across the caseloads of psychologists and counselors who work there. So when I came to UVA, staff there recognized that I had done a fair amount of work already with students having bipolar disorder, and they began to refer patients to me with bipolar disorder, and it was just something I gradually did more and more of. Go ahead.
And you're probably one of the few clinical psychologists I know that has this specialty. I mean, it's just not something as a profession we've felt we could be very effective with. And one of the things that has impressed me about your work is that you have really shown us that psychotherapy can be an important part of the treatment and maintenance of individuals with bipolar disorder. So that said, give us a sense of what exactly is bipolar disorder. What's been sort of the evolution of the disorder in terms of diagnoses, and what does it look like?
Sure. Well, your listeners may recall that many years ago it was referred to as manic depressive illness. And manic depressive illness essentially is the same thing as bipolar disorder. It's just a shift in nomenclature. Diagnostic and Statistical Manual began using bipolar disorder, I believe, DSM-3. And what it basically is a neurobiologic disorder. So it's not caused by environment. It's caused more by genetics and biologic vulnerability.
So there is a hereditary component.
Yeah, there's a strong hereditary component. And it reflects the brain's difficulty or deficiency in being able to maintain and regulate what we think of as mid-range or normal mood, right? So most of us, we go through the day, and if we're not upset or if we're not very happy, we experience what we think of as normal mood, okay?
Okay.
And the brain essentially keeps us, or the brain chemistry keeps us within that mid-range mood unless we're distressed or unless we're particularly happy. With bipolar disorder, there is a susceptibility to shift downward into depression. And when that shift occurs, it can often occur without any clear or identifiable cause. So one is going along, they're living their life, and next thing they know, they're progressing into a strong depression, and they may indeed be depressed for 2 weeks, 3 weeks, 5 weeks, 2, 3, 4 months. I mean, it comes on as an illness comes on. Now, the other side of that spectrum is where mood goes upward. And it's not as simple as we get happy. It's more like the mood begins to elevate, and in the early phases of elevation, indeed, people usually feel good. Their mood is up. They feel optimistic. They have increased energy. Their need for sleep begins to lessen. They're more productive. Their mind is moving faster. But if you imagine that as continuing upward on a continuum, such that the degree of energy and what's going on in the brain simply begins to ramp up, and it moves above normal range. It moves above what you would experience if you were simply happy due to normal circumstances. And so it can move on up to the level where you begin to feel out of control with it, such that the level of intensity of mood, energy, speed of thought, speed of speech, degree to which we start acting more upon impulses as opposed to utilizing good judgment about what is good or bad for us creates a lot of negative consequences in life. That point in mood elevation where one begins to lose control of choices and behavior is what we call mania, all right? And that range in between what you'd think of as normal good mood versus, or rather, normal good mood and mania is what we call hypomania, hypo being below. So with someone who lives with bipolar disorder, they will have periods of normal mood. They will experience periods of depressed mood, and they will also experience periods of mood elevation. It'll look different for each person. It isn't like there's any standard presentation of bipolar disorder. If you look at 100 different individuals with bipolar disorder, their mood variability and the mood intensity and the particular symptoms they have is going to be very unique to each of them.
Okay. And is there an age at which the onset of symptoms of bipolar illness is typically begin?
Well, we generally see it emerge somewhere between the mid-teens and the mid-20s.
Okay.
There is what we call childhood bipolar disorder. It's much more difficult to diagnose. Those who have the childhood form, it doesn't go away.
Okay.
It kind of progresses into late adolescence and adulthood. But for most who experience bipolar disorder, you'll see it emerge in late teens, early adulthood.
Okay.
And it is a chronic disorder. It tends to be lifelong. You don't get bipolar disorder and have it just go away. It's something that you really have to learn to live with.
And I know been some controversy about the diagnosis of childhood bipolar disorder. As an expert in this disorder, do you believe that there is such an illness, that it's not just something else that's being misdiagnosed?
You know, Jeff, I actually stay away from talking much about childhood
okay.
bipolar.
Didn't mean to put you on the spot.
Well, no, it's okay. I work mostly with adults, I really have not treated children.
Okay.
Or I haven't really treated folks younger than mid-teens.
Okay.
So I just don't have a lot of expertise in that area.
Okay, fair enough,
sure.
Fair enough. Now, there are categories of bipolar illness. It's not one size fits all, as you said, with regard to the presentation of the illness, but there are also variations on it. Can you tell us a little bit about
variations? Sure, there are basically two.
Okay.
There's bipolar 1 and bipolar 2. With bipolar 1, the individual's mood elevations will reach the acuity of full mania.
Okay.
Such that the individual with bipolar 1, when they destabilize and when their mood becomes elevated, they are prone towards full mania, and they may need hospitalization, indeed, as part of their medical treatment.
Okay.
Individuals with bipolar 2 don't experience full mania. They experience hypomania. Now, their hypomania can range between mild to strong, but they're still able to maintain a degree of control over their behavior. Now, that might sound like bipolar 2 is easier to live with. Actually, it's not.
Okay.
And it's not for a number of reasons. One, the individuals with bipolar 2 disorder typically experience a greater degree of depression. I don't necessarily mean more acute, but they're depressed more of the time than folks with bipolar 1. So with bipolar 2, you often see people being depressed 60 to 70% of the time, right? Now, bipolar 2, because the symptoms are on the lower end of the spectrum in terms of acuity, it's harder to spot.
Okay.
It's harder for the individual to identify when they may be out of mid-range, because the symptoms can be subtle, and because of that mild acuity, there's much more range for denial or simply for lack of good recognition of what's happening with them, and so their behavior can be affected. And unless they've lived with the disorder for a long time and have become good at identifying how they experience things, they can be affected without being fully aware of it, and that can have a lot of negative consequences as well.
And you use the term hypomanic. Would you tell us what that means to manic?
Yeah, well, the word hypo means below, like a hypodermic, right?
Right.
So hypomania is simply intensity of mood elevation that is below full mania. So it's that range between strong good mood and mania. And again, it is all of the symptoms that you see in mood elevation. So increased energy, increased speed of thought, impulsivity, altered perception of self, increased libido, optimism. I think I already said impulsivity.
Grandiosity, would that be one of them?
That's what I meant by altered perception of self. The other thing I want to add with this is that with elevated mood in bipolar disorder, you almost always see lessened need for sleep.
Okay.
All right? Now, that's a really important diagnostic issue, because if you had a very exciting day or if you had a very exciting series of events, you might be really up, right? And you might even not sleep as much for a couple of nights because you were excited,
right?
But if your baseline for sleep is, let's say, 8 hours, 8 or 9 hours, and you only get five, you're going to feel some degree of fatigue the next day, all right? For someone who's bipolar, in the earlier stages of their mood elevation, they may only be getting 4 or 5 hours if their baseline is 8 or 9, right? But for several days' time, they're not necessarily going to experience fatigue, right? The fatigue will indeed catch up with them in terms of sleep deprivation, and you begin to see a kind of loosening of cognition and unraveling of behavior and stuff that just begins to not make a lot of sense in terms of how someone approaches the world through their day-to-day behavior. Like, that'll affect all of us. I mean, if any of us experience extended sleep deprivation, we are deeply affected by it, right? So individuals with bipolar, if they're not getting adequate sleep because of mood elevation over the course of 5, 6, 8, 10 days, you'll begin to see a deterioration of behavior because of that. But in the early stages, they don't necessarily feel the fatigue because their system is energized. And they don't need the kind of recharging at night that most of us need when we go to sleep.
Okay. And is the lack of sleep ever something that can make the symptoms worse? I recall having experience with some folks at the hospital at UVA who the less sleep they got, the more manic they got, so it seemed.
That's accurate. Okay. And so when we're working with folks with bipolar, we often... We, meaning psychiatrists, often prescribe medications to help people to sleep if they're experiencing mood elevation, because adequate sleep for the bipolar is one of the most important things that those folks can integrate into their life.
And you're talking about ongoing. Need to be sleeping regularly. Absolutely. Throughout their life.
Absolutely.
Okay. Now, you know, in other forms of serious mental illness, schizophrenia comes to mind. There's often very active delusions, in other words, belief in things that aren't true or that are imagined or made up. Are delusions ever a part of what we see with bipolar individuals?
Well, delusions, or what we think of as psychoses, is seen, but you typically only see it in full mania.
Okay.
All right? So individuals with bipolar 2 don't experience full mania. Individuals with 1, when mood becomes strongly elevated, they are manic, and often you'll see manic psychosis. And manic psychosis can look very much like schizophrenic psychosis.
Okay.
That's one of the kind of diagnostic distinctions that psychiatrists have to make in their early assessment of bipolar disorder.
To make that distinction. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Correct.
I recall someone I worked with who had not previously been diagnosed as bipolar, and he very impulsively cashed in a considerable amount of investment, bought this ring, became convinced that some celebrity wanted to marry him, and he was going to fly to California and propose to her. I mean, is that generally, and ended up being diagnosed, by the way, bipolar, is that a typical, if there is such a thing, sort of belief system that sometimes comes?
Well, I wouldn't say it's typical, but what I'd say is it's well within the range of possibility.
Okay.
So as mood goes up and impulsivity increases and desire for pleasure increases, then you'll see people doing things that they wouldn't ordinarily do when their mood was not elevated.
Okay.
And indeed, some of that behavior entails excessive spending.
Yeah.
But, you know, the one thing I really want to convey to listeners is that I think one of the strongest misconceptions about bipolar disorder is that if you're bipolar, that means you're crazy. And the reality is that probably 2/3 of individuals with bipolar disorder lead reasonably functional lives. They have work. They have profession, they have families. In other words, their lives are not in disarray, particularly if they're getting good treatment. Now, there's about 1/3 of the bipolar population where symptoms are more acute and more frequent, and indeed they have frequent hospitalizations, and they're faced with a greater degree of disability. But I think those with bipolar, part of the stigma they often struggle with is the thought that if others know I am bipolar, they're going to assume that I am unstable and crazy. And indeed, I think that's probably one of the biggest misconceptions that we see. Now,
Okay. That
doesn't mean that when folks destabilize that they don't shift or they don't change. But much of the behavior that you see from individuals with bipolar most of the time is well within the normal range.
Okay. But when we see more pronounced behavior, it can be pretty dramatic. I remember some years ago a supervisor saying to me that the person we have to fish out of the fountain in front of City Hall is more likely to be manic than they are schizophrenic.
Correct.
Because it's a very dramatic sometimes presentation.
Correct. Correct. Most of the incidents with bipolar disorder that reach the media are kind of spectacular because people are indeed out of control with their behavior.
Okay, let's take a short break here. I just want to remind you, this is the Mind and Heart Show on WPVC. We're at 94.7 FM, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. I'm Dr. Jeffrey Frazier, your host, here every Saturday morning from 9 to 10. And we're talking this morning with Dr. Russ Fetterman, a clinical psychologist who has expertise in the diagnosis and treatment of bipolar disorder. So we'll take a short break and be right back, so stay tuned.
This is Scientific American's 60 Second Science. I'm Erica Barris. Got a minute? In Marcel Proust's iconic Remembrance of Things Past, a taste of cake elicits a flood of memories. Now a study finds that the stronger your memory of a particular food, the more likely you are to choose it again. And it doesn't matter how objectively unattractive the food may be, which perhaps explains why you may crave those peanut butter and marshmallow sandwiches from your youth or can't break that fried chicken habit when trying to diet. The food memory study is in the journal Neuron. Researchers asked 30 hungry young people to rate snacks such as potato chips and chocolate. No actual food was presented. The snacks were merely displayed on screens associated with locations. Then the study participants were asked to choose between two locations as proxies for the snacks. And the hungry subjects went with memory over taste preference. That is, they picked what they were better able to remember, even if they had rated them lower in the first part of the test. The participants' brains were scanned during the process of choosing, and the researchers found that the exercise caused increased communication between the hippocampus associated with memory and the part of the frontal lobe home to decision-making, which may show why when we're making food decisions, familiarity often wins out over other factors, and why your shopping list looks virtually the same week after week. Thanks for the minute. For Scientific American's 60 Second Science, I'm Erica Barris.
And we're back with the Mind and Heart Show. I'm your host, Dr. Jeffrey Frazier, and we'll get right back to our discussion with Dr. Russ Fetterman on bipolar disorder, but a real quick check of the weather. It is currently a bit cloudy out, 54 degrees in Charlottesville. We're actually looking for a high today of 70, so that should be ideal weather for the football game this afternoon between UVA and Virginia Tech. Tonight it's going to get low only in the low 50s, so we're continuing to have a warm spell, although there will be cooler weather at the beginning of the week with some expected rain, so plan accordingly. So, we've been talking this morning on the Mind and Heart Show with Dr. Russ Fetterman, who is an expert in the diagnosis and treatment of bipolar disorder, and we're going to continue that discussion. And I wanted to ask Russ at this point about genetic components. What do we know about the hereditary aspects of this illness? Does it, in fact, run in families? And Russ, what can you tell us about that?
Well, there are very strong genetic components for bipolar disorder. If you have a parent with bipolar disorder, you've got about a 20-25% chance of having a disorder. If you have a sibling, you have about a 20-25% chance. If you've got both parents with bipolar disorder, you've got probably about a 50% chance. If you have an identical twin with bipolar disorder, you have about an 80% chance. So as you can see from that data, this is conveyed genetically, but not necessarily. Like occasionally, we'll see someone with bipolar disorder and you look at their family tree and you do a careful family history. And indeed, there's no history of mental illness in the family anywhere that is identifiable. And when that occurs, we don't have a good way of understanding it except to say it is an anomaly and indeed the person has bipolar disorder. But why or where it came from genetically, it's not always easy to spot.
And it is, just let's just remind our audience, it is a brain disease. It's not a weakness or failing or anything negative about the person who's been diagnosed.
Yeah, you can have someone who, you know, for 14, 15, 16 years has had a very normal life without any psychological or psychiatric symptoms, and then the bipolar begins to emerge, and that's the kind of first appearance of any instability for that individual.
And, you know, in my work as a forensic psychologist, very often we'd see folks who had a manic episode and perhaps a first episode and would engage in some fairly bizarre behavior and might even involve criminal activity. But the question before the court would be, you know, was this person responsible for their own actions? So I do think that bipolar illness sometimes can have us behave in ways that are problematic in that way and in other ways. Is that fair to say, Russ?
Yes, and yet I would say it has everything to do with the acuity or degree of intensity of their mood. If you think of mild, and again, let's talk about mood elevation, because I think that's where you typically see behavior that is aberrant or behavior where people are getting in trouble. If you have mild degree of mood elevation, the individual is still relatively in control.
Okay.
It's only as you go up the continuum of intensity towards mania that you see increasing degree of loss of control. So let us not assume that anyone who is elevated in a bipolar elevated mood state does not have control of their behavior. I think that would be incorrect to assume. You know, there's another issue in terms of symptom presentation here, and that is folks with bipolar disorder often experience mixed states. And so it's a blend of negative symptoms and positive symptoms. So imagine someone who is feeling increasingly energetic, but increasingly angry and irritable. So it's kind of a mix of negative mood and high energy.
Okay.
And that can be part of bipolar destabilization. And from those who experience it, it's probably one of the most unpleasant experiences that they have.
Yeah.
And again, it's something that has to run its course. Of course, it has to also be treated with medication. But it isn't like the individual can just kind of reach over and find the volume knob and turn down the intensity. So it can be a very, very uncomfortable experience for folks who are caught in it.
That brings to mind a question. I've recalled some individuals in the past that I work with that would be poorly compliant with their medication because they enjoyed the high. They enjoyed the manic phase. They liked the sort of energy and the creativity they felt and the way they engaged with life. Is that a common thing we see with medication compliance with people that are in a manic phase of the illness?
Yes, it is. And I'd also let's also think about this developmentally. I think you have a more difficult time getting good medication compliance during the teenage years and early 20s.
Okay.
And why is that? Well, does any 19 or 20-year-old want to have bipolar disorder? Do they want to take medications that have side effects? Do they want to be different than others? They absolutely don't. And so let's say someone's taking a mood stabilizer, right? They're 19, they're 20. They've been on it for 6-9 months. And indeed, the mood stabilizer is doing what it is designed to do. It helps level out mood, and the symptoms that perhaps had been present are gone or greatly reduced. The individual is going to think, I don't need this medication. I'm doing fine. I mean, look at my behavior. I'm fine. I don't need this. Not only do they not need it, they don't want it. And so early on in people's gradually coming to terms with bipolar disorder, they face the issue of denial and non-acceptance and wanting to not be medication compliant or treatment compliant because they don't want the disorder.
Sure.
So I often see that folks have to struggle with this for a period of time before they truly learn that if they're going to live an effective, stable life, they need to maintain good, healthy lifestyle and good compliance with their medication.
And is there a danger for someone in continuing to go off the medication and then back on and off and on? I mean, I've heard that said, that this notion of what's called rapid cycling.
Well, there's something we call the kindling effect, and that is, okay, if you look at someone with a more acute early phase of their illness. So someone early on who chooses not to get treatment, and because they choose not to get treatment or because they choose not to remain on medication, they experience a greater degree of mood instability. The more mood instability that you have early in treatment, the worse is the prognosis for longer-term stability.
Okay.
So for someone who is unstable early on and they are treatment resistant, there are some strong implications in terms of their future lives, which is why we really, really try to get folks a lot of good education about what's important, what's needed in order to live a healthy life with bipolar disorder. Because if they ignore it, there are some long-term consequences, or at least potentially some long-term consequences that they're going to have to face.
So if you're just joining us, this is the Mind and Heart Show on WPVC 94.7, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. You're listening to the Mind and Heart Show, and we're here every Saturday morning from 9 to 10. This morning in the studio, I have Dr. Russ Fetterman as a guest, and he's talking about bipolar disorder. So, Russ, what can you tell us about treatment in terms of both the psychiatric side and the psychological side when dealing with a bipolar individual?
Sure. Well, psychiatrically, and again, I'm a psychologist, I'm not a psychiatrist, but psychiatrically, early on, when you first see the emergence of mood elevation, what's most important is to be able to flatten it out. In other words, help someone return to mid-range mood. And if mood elevation is strong, i.e. if someone is manic, they're typically hospitalized. And early treatment with mania is typically utilization of the atypical antipsychotic medication to help just bring down the intensity of manic behavior. Once behavior is stabilized, then longer-term treatment usually entails the use of mood stabilizers.
Those drugs as well?
Mm-hmm. Drugs. Yes. Most common mood stabilizers that we see used today are lithium and Lamictal. There are several others, but those are the ones that you see most commonly. Then you have to also look at what are the other symptoms that someone with bipolar disorder lives with. Do they have difficulty sleeping? Do they have a degree of insomnia? And sometimes, indeed, with bipolar, we see that. And since sleep is one of the cornerstones of mental health for someone with bipolar disorder, then it's not uncommon to have individuals take nightly medication to ensure that they get stable sleep. If someone has a strong anxiety disorder that is accompanying their bipolar disorder, then you've got to treat the anxiety symptoms as well. If you think of bipolar disorder as almost being like a volatile substance, all right, and what you want to do with a volatile substance is keep it stable. You don't want to shake it up. And so any things that are kind of disruptive or destabilizing for someone with bipolar disorder, you need to then help to treat those symptoms. And I don't just mean that we're talking about medication treatment. There's a very, very important part of living with bipolar disorder that has to do with healthy living, simply healthy living. So we're talking about regular, stable sleep patterns.
Okay.
So people are going to sleep and waking up at the same time every day. And I don't mean going to sleep and waking up at one time during the week and then an entirely different time on weekend, but you really want to stabilize sleep over time. Exercise is a very important component, not just with bipolar disorder, but with most psychological disorders or psychiatric disorders. You'll see that at least with clinical depression, exercise in the mild to moderate range of depression is as effective as antidepressant medication. I'm always encouraging the patients we see to get regular exercise because it will help to stabilize their mood. Living a fairly structured life such that what you're doing from one day to the next is relatively planned and stable and consistent. Again, if you think of this notion of trying to manage a volatile substance, you want to have that substance in a stable, safe container. And so the structure of one's life is that stable container. So having your life well-scheduled, well-planned, well-organized helps to maintain stability for the individual with bipolar disorder.
And I'm guessing diet as well. I'm thinking if someone's drinking 10 double espressos a day who's got episodes, a history of mania, it's probably not a
It's a absolutely good not a good thing, a good choice. So you want to minimize the use of stimulants. And maintain a healthy diet. Along with refraining from psychoactive substances. So one of the challenges in working with your late adolescents and early adults is that psychoactive substances, we're talking about alcohol and marijuana and other drugs that they may casually use with their friends, they're a fairly common part of university culture, right? Late teens, early 20s. And if you're bipolar and living in that world, you've got to learn to refrain from that, because that's one more contributing factor that will affect mood destabilization. That may be easy to say, but when you're 19 or 20 in the midst of your college years, to be able to step back and choose not to use alcohol or cannabis or other drugs that friends are using is not such an easy choice.
And back to the earlier question about what is the role of someone such as yourself, a psychologist, in treating bipolar disorder from a psychotherapeutic perspective?
Well, the first part of the work really has to do with acceptance, all right? As I said earlier, no one wants bipolar disorder. And I find that really coming to accept the role of the illness in one's life often is a several-year endeavor. And it's revisiting it again and again and again until someone develops the kind of peace within themselves, the acceptance within themselves to say, all right, yes, I do indeed have this, and so how do I live well with it, as opposed to rejecting the illness and trying to deny it or ignore it. Now, that acceptance entails a degree of mourning. It's almost like the individual has to mourn the loss of the self that they had hoped to be without bipolar. A bipolar life is going to look different than a non-bipolar life. Now, I'm not saying it's a worse life, but it's a different life, all right? And if you think of someone at age 20, 21, where so much of their energy is focused on kind of future aspirations, then coming to terms with how am I going to live with this disorder in my life, and how am I going to be able to adapt well, that takes some significant psychological, emotional work, all right? Now, I mentioned other comorbid symptoms, so symptoms such as anxiety, right? If you've got an anxiety disorder along with bipolar disorder, then you're going to need the psychotherapy to help someone become less anxious. And even with regard to treating depression, there are a lot of things that we as psychologists do to help people out of depression, having to do with helping them with a healthy lifestyle, helping them to look at the accuracy of the thoughts versus the distortion that they may have in their thoughts. Typically, when someone is depressed, they're viewing things negatively and pessimistically. They're viewing themselves with distortion. And so helping someone to adjust their thought patterns such that the thoughts that they're having in their mind are more accurate and reality-based and less prone towards depression is an important part of psychotherapy. I think helping people with relapse prevention, or even when one does relapse, let's say you're in your mid-40s and you've been living well for a year or two without many symptoms, and then out of the blue you have a manic episode and you wind up back in the hospital. Essentially, your life is derailed for a month or two until you get back on track, and helping people with the emotional implications of all that, their sense of shame, their sense of guilt, their guilt in relation to their family, their guilt in relation to behavior that might have gotten them in trouble, just, again, helping them to come to terms with it all and get themselves back into life in a normal progression is an important part of helping people live with the disorder.
So, that all being said, how do you diagnose this disorder? If someone refers to you, they know you specialize in this, they bring their 19-year-old, or they arrange an appointment for their 19-year-old daughter, what happens in terms of how you think about, is this bipolar illness or is this something else?
Well, you've heard me talking thus far about a lot of the different symptoms that we have in bipolar disorder. So a very careful and detailed history of mood patterns and behavior is essential for the diagnosis. Unfortunately, with bipolar disorder, we're not yet at a place where we can order an MRI or look at an X-ray or look at a blood test and somehow see the bipolar disorder through objective results. It is all based on clinical information. And the clinical information entails broad patterns, not just what you see in front of you.
Okay.
Because behavior changes over time, and someone may be depressed in the moment. They look depressed. There's no evidence of any mood elevation. It doesn't mean that there hasn't been mood elevation in the past. And so the diagnostic process is a matter of very careful, in-depth interview with the patient and sometimes with the family as well. And if anyone arrives at a diagnosis of bipolar disorder in less than an hour, they're probably being premature. With my own clinical work, I typically refrain from anything diagnostically until I've seen someone for 2 or 3 hours, because you really need to accrue a lot of information to get an accurate picture. There are a lot of other diagnoses that can look like it, right? People with personality disorders, particularly disorders in the borderline or the narcissistic realm, sometimes they can masquerade and look like bipolar disorder. Anxiety symptoms can often look like mood elevation symptoms. Someone with ADHD can sometimes often look bipolar in terms of the elevated energy and the racing thoughts and the difficulty focusing. And so just being able to tease all that apart, and as well as looking at their genetic background in terms of family history and factoring that in, it's just a complex clinical process of doing some careful exploration.
And it would seem to me that clinicians with less experience with this disorder might be at greater risk to miss the diagnosis or to even diagnose them incorrectly.
Well, what we've seen through numerous studies is that the period of time between early onset of symptoms and eventual accurate diagnosis for someone with bipolar disorder is often 10 to 12 years.
Oh, my gosh.
So it is often missed.
Yeah.
Correct. It is often missed.
Yeah.
And you really do need to know what you're looking for in order to be able to accurately arrive at the diagnosis.
But I assume, and I'm recalling here again, that it is possible for someone in their 30s, 40s, 50s to become, to develop bipolar illness, even though they don't necessarily have a known history, let's say, or how would you think about
that?
Well,
sure. I mean, every now and then you'll have late onset,
okay,
without any good reason. You know, I've seen individuals who have their first manic episode at age 50. And how do we understand that except to say it's an unusual occurrence? This isn't typically what it looks like. It's essentially anomalous. But that doesn't mean it's not a manic episode.
Yeah.
So, yes, sometimes the pattern we see doesn't necessarily fit the norm.
Do we see gender differences? Is it more frequently seen in men or women?
No, it's not.
So
it's an equal
opportunity illness.
Correct.
Okay. We've talked some already today about dealing with young adults. Certainly I know that was true when you were at the university. Are there specific challenges that you see with, you alluded to one earlier, I think, but other specific challenges you see with younger people with an onset of bipolar illness?
I think the biggest issue they deal with, again, is this sense that their life has been altered and coming to terms with that, as well as the issue of stigma. When I was at the university for my last 6 years while I was there, I ran a bipolar student support group. And indeed, that group is still ongoing at CAPS. I also have one in my practice for university students. I also have one in my practice for adults who are professionals diagnosed with bipolar disorder. But in terms of the late adolescent young adult population, their stigma, their own sense of stigma, feeling different and feeling like they no longer fit in, as well as feeling kind of embarrassed and ashamed about their diagnosis, is very significant. And for them to be able to sit and openly talk with others who share this diagnosis can be a tremendous relief. It can very much help young adults to normalize what they're experiencing, to realize that it's not just them, that there are others who have similar issues, and they can learn from others and indeed receive support from others. So whenever I'm working with a young adult or a late teen who is initially diagnosed, I'm strongly encouraging that they find a support group. It can be enormously helpful.
Okay. If you would speak to the issue of what we call dual diagnosis, I know folks in the past that I've worked with might be using alcohol excessively or other medications or illegal drugs to try to manage their symptoms. Is that a problem that you could say something about, the so-called dual diagnosis?
It's a common issue with bipolar. Drugs and alcohol change the way we feel. And if we're feeling uncomfortable and we want to change that discomfort into something else, if we take some drug or if we drink four or five drinks, usually we change our experience. And so often you'll see folks probably prior to their diagnosis trying to manage their symptoms with substances. They may not know they have bipolar disorder, but they're using substances. And then once they indeed are diagnosed, they may continue to use substances because it's simply part of the peer group behavior. And it's really not good for bipolar disorder. It's one of the worst.
So you would emphasize that to someone. You would say you really need to stay away from, you know, those six beers you're drinking.
Absolutely,
every night.
Absolutely. But saying it and achieving it are not the same.
Sure.
Especially if someone who's 18 or 19.
Yeah,
right.
Makes sense.
Right.
What about this issue of some folks that are bipolar feeling that they're much more creative, much more energized to be creative when they're manic, and for that reason don't necessarily want to dampen it down with mood stabilizing drugs?
Well, that's one of the painful trade-offs. People who experience hypomania often identify very positive aspects of the hypomania, or even, well, I don't know that anyone thinks of their mania as positive. Usually if they're manic, they're fully out of control. But with hypomania, if you think of elevated energy, rapid thought, neural connections that are just happening more readily, increased creativity, elevated libido, all of that can feel good. And we'll sometimes see folks indeed be more creative during that period of time. If they're going to take mood-stabilizing medications that help to keep them out of that realm of mood elevation, sometimes they have to give something up in order to maintain their stability, and that's not an easy trade-off.
So
you often see people feeling resistant to medication because they don't want to live without their periods of mood elevation.
Looks like we're almost out of time this morning, and there's so much more that I wanted to talk to you about or ask you about, and we may have to have you back to finish the conversation. But tell us a little bit about where they could contact you if they have questions. Do you have a website? Do you have an email where you can be reached if folks do want to follow up from our show?
Sure, Jeff. I'm in practice here in town. My website is my name, so it's www.russfetterman.com.
One word.
And on that website, you'll find my email address. You'll also find a lot of good information about bipolar disorder. So if folks want to follow up and speak with me, they're welcome to do so.
And they can also check out your blog online at psychologytoday.com. Russ writes a regular blog
there.
Yeah,
it's titled Bipolar U.
Great. If you joined us late or you're just joining us, let me remind you that you can listen to the show today on our podcast, which is on Cville Podcast. That's one word, Cville. Podcast, podcast.com, and just look for Mind and Heart Show when you get to that website. Russ, I really want to thank you. This has been very informative. Really appreciate your giving us part of your Saturday morning to come in and talk about bipolar illness. And I'd like to have you back at some point to talk about other aspects of what you do.
Well, you're very welcome. Thanks, Jeff.
Great.